welcome to another exciting episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette, the world's best Murder, She Wrote podcast. I'm your host, Bridget Keyes, and I'm joined today by Taylor Cole Miller. Taylor's an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse and director of the Communication and Media Lab there, but he's better known as TV Doc on TikTok. And Taylor and I have known each other for like almost 10 years in the media studies circle. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I was just walking along the sea cliffs by myself, trying not to think about the bleakness of my life when you called. So thank you for having me.
Perfect. So today we're going to talk about season 4, episode 12, Who Threw the Barbitals in Miss Fletcher's Chowder, which is one of my favorite episodes.
Yes.
It's delightful. Taylor, will you give us like a really quick summary for people who might not remember this episode?
I can sure try. So this is a great, and let me just say to your ardent listeners that I am a big fan of Murder, She Wrote, but I have not seen every episode of Murder, She Wrote. So cue the gasping music.
We should say that like your specialty is the 70s, right? And like moving into the 80s.
Yes. Whenever we talk about being TV scholars, usually we don't necessarily mean that we have like an encyclopedic knowledge of particular episodes or anything like that. So when I go home to my family, they're always trying to quiz me on like what happened in this episode of MASH. I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But as I understand, this is one of the last appearances of the sheriff, right? Tom Bosley's character.
Yeah.
And so what I really love about this episode is that this is really an Amos episode. In his, I think, his penultimate appearance, we get a whole cast of characters in this episode specifically to tell us about his life. And in some ways, Jessica is kind of just an afterthought in this episode. But here is what the episode is about. So Amos's sister, Winnie, suddenly drops in for a visit to the sheriff's office. And she has announced that she is leaving her husband. And the appearance of an Amos family member, of a Tupper family member, is really surprising to Jessica Fletcher, who he then tries to pawn his sister Winnie off onto. The episode is really an exploration of what really happened between Winnie and her husband when her husband and, I guess, his siblings or her siblings or Amos's siblings come to town to try and figure out what's going on with these two characters. And someone has slipped something into JB's chowder, and that has caused the unfortunate Elmo to pass away, Winnie's husband. I'm not sure if I'm doing a really good job on the episode summary, but my favorite part of this episode, of course, is the B story. I guess it's the B story, which is Colleen Camp's deputy Marigold Feeney in the episode. I think there's a lot of crossover typically between Murder, She Wrote fandom and Clue fandom. And so it's always nice to have a Clue actor drop in on the storyline. And so in addition to sort of the main A story about this murder of this woman who may or may not have been battered by her husband, we also have this great story of a sheriff's deputy that adds a lot of nuance and richness to Amos's life. So we can kind of see him from a variety of different angles. And I think it's really a tribute to Amos, even though he doesn't come across super great in the episode.
He never does. But, you know, you're making a really great point. I actually admittedly have not thought of this episode as an Amos episode. And of course, it totally is, because both the main plot and the subplot are about him, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's about Winnie and her husband's death, but they're interconnected with Amos because it's his sister. And then, as you're saying, the B plot is Colleen Camp getting hired to be a female deputy and Amos sort of grappling with his own sort of internal misogyny against that. And it provides a lot of humor, but I think as Murder, She Wrote always does, it touches upon issues of 1980s feminism in really great ways. And it's all adds up to being about like, tell us more about Amos.
Yes. And I mean, one of the things that I love so much about this episode too, is that one of the weird things, so as an outsider, of the Murder, She Wrote fandom, when you aren't really used to watching every single episode, what you notice is how odd it is that the show is just slam-packed full of characters who really don't matter. And of course, the reason for that is because the show is trying to give you a whole lot of options for suspects. Mm-hmm. And so usually when you watch any given random Murder, She Wrote episode, there's going to be like, I don't know, 7 or 8 characters who eventually go nowhere. But they're all typically related to the murder plot. So they could all potentially be characters in this murder plot. And what I love about this episode is Marigold is never a suspect, at least from my reading of it. Like, she is merely there for nuancing Amos's life and providing some fun kind of intertextual humor for any audience member maybe who knows about her appearance as the maid in Clue.
I love her character, and I love the way that she, you know, calls Amos out. I hope you're not biased, you know, against women. And he's like, oh, man, can't you just, like, be a meter maid or something? And she's – we see her cleaning a gun and refusing to do, you know, like, why isn't the phone being answered, or why isn't there coffee, or any of the tasks that we think of as, like, traditionally feminine tasks. She's like, I'm not doing that. Oh, I just love it. I love it. And I love how brusque she is with him, and – she even gets into a fight with one of the only time she sort of intersects the murder plot is when she gets into a fight with Donnelly Rhodes' character, we'll talk about in a second, who's like a PI, and they wrestle in the backyard of Jessica's house.
She
and
flips him, man. At first you think, oh, okay, she doesn't really know what she's doing, but like, she gets there and she flips him and then piles on him. It's great.
She's amazing. So maybe we should keep talking about the guest stars then. So she's played by Colleen Camp, who people at this point probably know. You've mentioned Clue. We also know her as the first Kristen in Dallas. Not the Kristen who ends up shooting JR. That's Mary Crosby. But this was the first introduction to Sue Ellen's sister, Kristen.
Yes.
And I got to tell you, I hate her in Dallas. I don't think she's right for the part. I think they styled her hair really ugly. And I love her in this episode.
Yes. Yes, I love that you don't like someone because of how their hair was styled.
I mean, I feel like that's really important, right? Like, if you want me to get on board with an actor and a character, they have to have pretty hair.
Yeah, there are great. There are some great guest stars. Of course, I have to talk. Okay, so I am just about to come out with a Golden Girls book, a Golden Girls reader, with contributions from 12 different professors.
I don't know why we didn't put that in your bio. Like, that would be the biggest... like, reason why you would be on a Murder, She Wrote podcast, because they have such crossover, right?
Yeah, selling point. And there are 2 guest characters from this episode who are well-known in the Golden Girls community. Jeffrey Lewis, who plays Kenny, he is in the most hated Golden Girls episode there is, the backdoor pilot for Empty Nest.
Oh, I hate that episode.
Everyone does. I hate it, too. There are a couple great moments in it, but...
I know, but we love Rita. That's fine. That she's allowed.
She really got hosed on that deal. And then, of course, Ed Donnelly Rhodes plays the incredible Jake, one of Blanche's best beaux on the show. And I love that in the show, he's a caterer, but they go to this lobster place. And I don't know, it kind of fits with his character, this sort of gruff, handsome, hunky, older man. So when I saw him like tailing around Winnie, I thought, ooh, I don't know if I'd mind that. But then I was like, wait, that's creepy. But then I was like, but it's Jake, the best.
Yes.
The best of the bows. So I was really excited to see both of them.
He always sort of plays characters like that, right? Like on Soap, he's the, he's not an ex-con, he's an escaped convict who falls in love with the rich daughter. And it's the same kind of thing, right? He's like really gruff and classless, but it's hot.
He's so dreamy in some way. If you didn't see him, like if you just saw him walking down the street, you might. He's one of those people. And I have a friend and I who like talk about. There are those people who, if you just saw them on the street, you wouldn't give them a second look. But because of specific personality traits, like, you are there for them. And I got to tell you, anything I see Donnelly in, I'm like, oh, there he is. This is Jake.
Did you watch Battlestar Galactica?
I did not. No, he's in that.
He is. He's Doc Coddle. He's like, I mean, same thing. He's like this super gruff, but he's like actually a doctor. So he has an education in that in a different way. But yeah, he's like gruff and like no nonsense. And he's just being Donnelly Rhodes.
Yeah, I really think that's what it is. I mean, he didn't even have much of an... He's one of those characters who's meant just to be a suspect, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I love how he's just in Jessica's backyard, just looking around for stuff, and then Marigold comes along.
I mean, I think actually before we even know what the murder is, he's kind of set up to maybe be a murderer and maybe to be murdering Winnie, because we don't really know what's going on, but we see lots of shots of him following Winnie when she gets off the bus in Cabot Cove. We see him spying and lurking on people all the time. And eventually we learned he was actually a private eye who was hired by Winnie's husband to find her.
Yes.
And then he's following Winnie's husband because he owes him money because he never paid him for the job, which makes him therefore a suspect in the husband's death. But actually, he's just like a good guy.
And then he runs off with the girl at the end as they both board a bus. Do you like a window seat or do you like an aisle seat?
They've both been screwed over by Elmo. Why not run off together?
Yes. Yeah, so both of those characters were really fun to see. And then, of course, Anne, right? She's from ALF.
And Mira, mm-hmm. Who plays Winnie.
Yes, Winnie from ALF. She plays Kate's mother in ALF.
Why do you like ALF so much? You're always talking about it.
Okay, so I have a syllabus Easter egg. And I did not come up with this idea, but I have never heard anyone else do it. So it feels like it was my idea, but it wasn't.
Just to hide
an Easter egg in your syllabus. Yeah. To hide an Easter egg in your syllabus that is an ALF meme. So write down in the writing center portion of my syllabus. Oh, if for any of my students who are listening now, you know the secret.
That's what I was thinking.
They're buried in that language that I like try and get them to read in order to understand who read the syllabus and who did it. I say, if you are reading this, be one of the first 6 people to send me an ALF meme and I will give you some extra credit points. And I do this in part because I want to know who read the syllabus and who did it. It's like that writer thing with concert or with bands who have something in the writer that says, I want a bowl of brown M&Ms. And it's not because that's all they want. They just want to know that their entire writer with all of the lights, information, the setup and everything is done safely and in a detailed way. I do the same thing with my syllabus. So what'll end up happening ultimately is I'll get 3 at the very beginning of the semester. And I'm like, okay, those are the ones who read the syllabus. And then throughout the course of the semester, I'll get ALF memes from students who are just catching up on the syllabus or looking at it. And it provides me joy in my email inbox, which is hard to come by sometimes. But it also makes me aware of when students are checking the syllabus and then maybe going back and reviewing the syllabus in my class around those times. So I love ALF in part just because, you know, ALF is just such a wacky, random TV character from my childhood. But also because literally every semester of my life, I'll have 20 or 30 emails that have ALF memes in them from students who have absolutely no idea who ALF is.
I was going to say, do you pick ALF because they don't know who it is and then that forces them to kind of learn?
I pick ALF because the person, whoever came up with this idea picked ALF. And so it's just become kind of a love letter to me, this character. And so now every time I see any ALF memorabilia or anything, I always get it. Like I have in my backseat of my car, this ALF, it's one of those anxiety hugger things that shakes when you hug it.
And it's ALF?
It's ALF, yeah. And his sunglasses and chain.
Oh my God, I loved ALF when I was little, but now I don't know if I could watch it because the thing about eating cats would just make me too sad.
He never does. He'll put it between 2 slices of bread and then someone will catch him just in time or whatever.
Funny. Anyway, so Anne Mira is in ALF.
Yes, so she plays... The mother character in the show, she plays her mother, Dorothy. And ALF and her do not like each other at all. And I think ALF even calls her the Wicked Witch of the West, which I think is potentially a Wizard of Oz reference since her name is Dorothy in the show. But yeah, they don't like each other. And so it kind of you get to play this really comedic character off a literal puppet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I'm correct, she typically plays a sort of comedic character in things that she's in. So it was fun to see her in a little bit more of a serious role, even though it's sometimes hard to take her seriously because of her appearance at ALF.
Yeah.
And that I'm sure your audience has talked about intertextuality before, but every time you see a guest star, you bring the weight of a previous performance into the current text that you're consuming or watching. And so sometimes it's really hard to do, but I think that she does it pretty successfully in this episode.
You know, one of the things we talk about a lot on the Cabot Cove Gazette is also how that, what you're talking about, the history that we bring that we can't get away from, we're often doing that in reverse with shows like Murder, She Wrote, right? Because we, like Alf comes afterward, right? This episode's 88. Isn't Alf after that? Or maybe right around the same time starting? So, and I'm also thinking about her appearance in Sex and the City, which is foremost on my mind when I see Anne Meara. And so those are all like later appearances, but like, you know, I'm watching Murder, She Wrote now in 2024 and all of that later stuff gets folded into how I interpret who she is as a star, right?
Yeah. So you watched Murder, She Wrote back in the day then.
I did. I've never not watched Murder, She Wrote.
I love that for you.
So I've probably had reinterpretations, which actually is a thing you talk about, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes. It's something that I've theorized in my work, because my work is specifically about television syndication. And in our field, in media studies, we're constantly talking about how a television show is a text, and the text is not merely the content of the show, but it's also the commercials, the on-screen graphics, the way that shows are laid out on a schedule, etc. And so I kind of thought, well, if that's true, then all of these shows that I'm studying through reruns, they're different texts. And so I took inspiration from the notion of intertextuality to suggest that when we watch or rewatch an episode in a different situational context, it really is a completely different experience. Because if it is true in media studies, in our field, in television studies, that the flow of a particular episode is semantically meaningful to our reading of it, then it is also true that if you completely change that situational context, it fundamentally changes itself. So I did an article on Bewitched, because Bewitched played on two very different television channels. One was on Family Net, which was owned by Jerry Falwell and was, of course, really oriented toward the family Christian audience. In that show, of course, Darren is ultimately more powerful than Samantha, because by the end of the episode, she returns to wanting to be immortal again. But at the same time, it was nestled with Drag Queens on Logo, at the time with RuPaul's Drag Race. And even RuPaul has adopted a bewitched phrase, "Oh my stars." So how does one particular show appeal to very politically and culturally distinct audiences? That's one of the things that I was trying to look at.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that you watched this way back when, and now you're kind of going through and rewatching it and renegotiating and bringing new weight from other roles, that has to be a really fascinating experience for you. And I love that for you.
You know, I think in many ways, Murder, She Wrote also does what you're talking about in terms of tapping into two different audiences. I mean, I write in my work about how, you know, it was on CBS. It's the sort of conservative network. It appealed to the sort of Law and Order set, right? Like the murder is always solved. Justice always prevails. And there's something really sort of conservatively comforting about that. But at the same time, it has all these themes of feminism. I mean, Birds of a Feather is really the only episode that touches explicitly on drag, and it doesn't actually even delve into the LGBTQ community. But the show has been taken up by queer audiences and camp, and we see lots of Jessica Fletcher cosplay and drag. And
yes.
So I think also it's another example of a show that has these like really different audiences, which I love.
Yes. And one thing I will say is, you know, as the Golden Girls scholar that I am.
Yes. Could we call you one of the world's foremost Golden Girls scholars?
I hope so.
Can we do that?
I hope so. The Murder, She Wrote has the distinction of being one of the only shows in the early 90s that survived something called granny dumping. And so in our field, we talk a lot about the rural purge in like 1969, when all of those country shows were canceled so that they could have city shows. But something also happened in the early 90s, which is where there were a lot of shows with older actors in them, like In the Heat of the Night, Matlock, The Golden Girls. They were all canceled in favor of shows like Mad About You, where you had a much, much younger cast. Murder, She Wrote is one of the only shows, and in part probably because it's on CBS, that survives that.
Mm-hmm.
But what we find out when we fast forward, I don't know, 20, 30 years, is that all of those little queer proto-queer kids in the early 90s were watching those shows with the older, fabulous women.
Yep.
And that because Murder, She Wrote gets to carry on, it gets to keep going when all of those other shows were canceled, it gets to really provide this rich and very long season or a series of seasons for those queer kids to come up on. I am so jealous because I didn't actually get to watch Murder, She Wrote until I was much older. And so thinking about having Jessica Fletcher in my life from my proto-queer childhood, I just love that for you so much.
Wait, did you watch Golden Girls when you were little?
Oh, yeah. I watched Golden Girls with my grandma.
But not Murder, She Wrote.
But not Murder, She Wrote, no. I think...
That's wild.
I think that, the aesthetics are quite... The aesthetics are quite different. And I was obsessed with Angela yes. Lansbury because of Beauty and the
Bed
Beast.
Knobs? Oh, okay. Okay, you're a little younger. Yeah.
But... I weep for my childhood for not having had the show because it would have been so important as a queer show for a kid. If only yeah. those executives had known that actually we didn't want shows with younger people in them. We loved the shows with these older.
We wanted divas we yes, could emulate, absolutely. Right? So TJ, my former host TJ and I used to joke about like paper ideas. So I think you've just given me one, like papers that will never be written. It's Murder, She Wrote Made Me Gay, right? That's a... Somebody can write that essay.
Honestly, I mean, with Jake, how could it not? I've got to go take a cold shower here.
So can we talk a little bit about any episode set in Cabot Cove? I think it always becomes really fun to see the Seth and Jessica and Amos dynamic. And the last time we saw them, the time that they were cooking and Amos got squeezed out, but they're always being so mean to him, I think. And this episode's really different because Jessica's just like, I'm busy, leave me alone. She's trying to frantically finish a novel and she's like, go away, everybody leave me alone. And so really we get more of Seth's involvement, I think, than he would normally be involved with Amos's life.
Yeah.
Like Winnie even goes to stay at Seth's house when her husband turns up at Amos's and she's like, I am not staying in a house with that guy. And why would she? He's an abuser. And everyone acts like it's weird that she doesn't want to stay with him.
Yeah, totally. It is such a messy storyline. And I really yeah. think shows yeah. how different the world actually is.
Yes. Murder, She Wrote does such a bad job with domestic abuse, man. They really do. Yeah. But that's yeah. by a 2020 standard.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that I think that just shows like where we've come mm-hmm. from. I mean, that the fact that no one would have probably questioned it at the time, I presume,
right?
Which is what makes retextuality a fun concept, because you can think about how completely different the cultural change in between your first and second screenings can be to completely influence your understanding of a show. So right now, I'm rewatching Grey's Anatomy. That's a show that, of course, is still on. And we tend to think of it as just like this consistent presence. But when you go and watch those early first seasons, it is just a mess of Me Too. I watched Grey's Anatomy from the beginning, unlike this. And so I'm having the retextuality experience with it. And looking back at episodes in those first few seasons, I'm shocked by literally how far television representation has come with regard to thinking about things like gender equality, justice, and social equity. I mean, it's not perfect, of course, but I think a lot has actually changed.
Yeah, it has. And I mean, this is a really good episode for seeing that. I'm thinking of the other one where the one that always stands out to me is Jessica meets the TV producer who, you know, and they're just like, she's like, I am Mrs. Fletcher. I am not Ms. Fletcher, right? And we see them sort of... having these generational divides between their levels of feminism. And here we have both the A plot and the B plot are about like, what is women's place in society, right? Like Anne Meara has fled Tennessee or Kentucky or wherever because her husband he has become addicted to pills. He is abusive. He's an alcoholic. She's like, I don't have to live like this. And then we also have Colleen Camp's character saying, I deserve a place on the sheriff's force. Like, there's no reason why I can't do this job, especially in a town like Cabot Cove, really. Like, what, how difficult can this job be? Even if the job were difficult and not in Cabot Cove, I would assert that women could do it. But I'm just saying, you know, like if Amos's argument is this is too dangerous for women or something, it's freaking Cabot Cove. Like the last deputy, all he did was like have sex with women. That was like his whole job. So like, I'm sure she can have sex with women. That's fine. She can do that. Anyway, I don't really know where I'm going with this. But now that I've mentioned gay stuff, can we talk about Seth for a second?
Wait, no, I want to compliment you because now I know why you host the show. That was such an elegant encapsulation of, you know, really the legacy of an episode like this. So bravo. That was so fun to listen to.
Oh, I love this show so much. But can we talk about Seth being gay for a second now that I've brought up gay stuff?
Okay.
So we here at the Cabot Cove Gazette, Taylor, we at the Cabot Cove Gazette, it is part of our doctrine that Seth is gay, and that is why he and Jessica are best friends and why he never marries. It is not, in fact, a little romance between them, even though the season 5 conclusion was written that way. It is actually that he's gay. And so what I love about this episode is that, like, his sense of impropriety when Winnie wants to spend the night. They're like, oh my God, people will talk. This is, you can't stay in my house. I'm a single guy. And then like the scandal when people find out she did stay there. I absolutely love it. I love how uncomfortable he is. I just love it. So anyway, I'm curious to know, as someone coming into the Cabot Cove Gazette now as a guest, who also does queer media studies, please give me your take on Seth and Winnie.
Well, I'm really glad you asked that because I was actually confused by this for a whole other reason. I didn't have a queer reading of Seth until you just mentioned it. And now all of the...
Get off my podcast, man.
All of the puzzle pieces have now come together because he seems really excited about the prospect of her at first. Maybe potentially because she's a patient. And because he's so giddy at seeing JB, right?
So did you read it as he thought she was like attractive? And that's why he was excited to meet her?
At first.
I think it's probably written that way, right?
Yeah, I bet so. But it's very clear later on in the episode that he is not feeling anything. He's feeling no stirring in his loins. There is nothing there for Winnie. And the show attempts to make her into kind of an object of lust for multiple characters. I mean, literally one person is attempting to like fight to keep her in his life, and then she runs off with another man, and there's this other guy, and he is just categorically not interested in her in any way. And they don't, unless they've deleted it from the episode, they don't give us a plot reason why he would suddenly want to turn away from her, unless, as I extrapolate now from hearing your reading of him, unless he thought she was just going to be a friendly face, and then ultimately she became more of a, like, attempting to seduce him kind of a face.
Yeah, like,
I don't know.
Maybe he's like, oh, I'm really excited to meet you because you can give me all of the gossip on Amos. Yes. And then she's like, oh, you're excited to meet me. You like me. And he's like, oh, God, no, I don't. I'm gay. And that's what's going on. We also get in this episode, it's actually, if you guys watch Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, they use this as a commercial to advertise Murder, She Wrote reruns now. We get the amazing scene where he calls Jessica and she pretends to be her own answering machine.
That's such a classic moment.
This is actually a great moment. And he's like, you don't have an answering machine. Nice try. But that's when he's so panicked about the idea of Winnie sleeping over. I love that scene.
So panicked. And it must have been an animal. I don't know. And something's on that. Yeah. I mean, listen, I'll tell you what a gay guy is not going to do. A gay guy is not going to go out onto the front porch and investigate a strange sound. Like, there's a burglar. Let that burglar stay outside. The door is locked. Let me close my office door. You can admire the certificates on my wall. Yeah, I totally get the queer reading of Seth. It is all there. I don't know how I didn't see it before.
Listeners, it wasn't just me and it wasn't just TJ. Now it's fact.
Yes, it is.
So, I mean, the title of the episode, as you said, it comes from the fact that somebody put phenobarbitals in the clam chowder and everybody gets knocked out. And then we have a comical, this is one of the comedies of the series, which is sort of alarming given the themes of addiction and domestic violence. But it's one of the comedy episodes. And so we have this like great scene of Jessica and Seth and Amos, like, trying to pick people up and make them walk around while they're like half unconscious to keep them alert don't like succumb to the drugs. But of course, Elmo was dosed differently than everyone else. That was just like a red herring to distract us from the fact that the drugs were actually put in his drink and he's actually keeled over dead. And all I can think in this whole scene is like, Jessica rushed to finish her novel, graciously invited these people whom she does not know into her home to throw them a dinner party that had to have been very expensive. She's serving everybody lobster. Everyone gets
It's not one. It's not two. It's not three. It's like five or six lobsters she pulls out of that pan.
Yes. This is a very expensive meal. And all they're doing is griping that the food is gross and they don't want to eat it. And then somebody takes this opportunity to kill someone, which of course makes her kind of a suspect, except not really because she's Jessica. I'm like, what a bunch of ingrates, man. These people are awful. They call her clam chowder wallpaper paste.
I found a recipe for Jessica Fletcher's clam chowder minus the barbitols online somewhere. So if anyone actually eats clam chowder, I invite you to take that up on Google. Yeah, that whenever I see things like that on television where, you know, they're picking them up and trying to walk them around, I just think about all the people who use television educationally and how likely it is that someone passed out and the person was like, oh, we got to stand them up and walk them around the room.
Walk them around, slap the face, make them drink coffee. Surely this will cure them.
Yeah. And but so when I watched this on Peacock, it starts with, here's what's happening tonight on Murder, She Wrote. And they clearly show Tom Bosley's character dying. And I thought, oh, wow, which episode am I watching? I had no idea that this was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of that apparently is a difficult stunt usually to do, to have your head slammed down on a table like that. And so I was really, really worried in that scene. And then, of course, he was fine. And I was like, oh, Murder, She Wrote, you did it again.
Murder, She Wrote does it again. My favorite is there's one where Jessica has a gun pointed on her right before the commercial break, like point blank, and the guy fires, and it's cut to commercial. And when we come back, the gun has magically misaimed and missed her. Like, there's no way she's living through that. Come on.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the reason why we think about commercials as part of the episode. I will say, so I watched it on Peacock. I don't know how you watched it. I was going to look at it on Prime, but then I got a notification that now there are commercials on Prime. And that just made me mad for some reason. So even though I have Peacock with commercials too, I watched it there.
I got commercials on Netflix now. I hate it. I'm like,
oh, what?
I will watch commercials everywhere, but Netflix? Come on.
Yeah. Anyway, so I just wanted to shout out two commercials that essentially came up over and over and over again for me. Mm-hmm. One of them was for a TV show called Them, which is about the pursuit of a serial assassin. Like, they're trying to catch the serial assassin. I thought, well, that works.
Yeah.
And then the other one seemed a little on the nose as a queer person without children. And it was an Airbnb commercial specifically about how, if you're going on vacation, why would you stay at a hotel with kids?
Oh, yeah. I've seen that one a lot. Mm-hmm.
I also want to say this episode is so quotable. There are so many things that I thought, I'm going to use that in my intro quote. But can I just say, you think I killed Elmo with my ulcer medicine? Don't mind me. I'm just grumpy because I left everything to the last minute. How wonderful are the quotes in this episode? I just love it.
Yeah. You guys, as we were getting started today, Taylor actually said the grumpy because he left everything to last minute. And I have to tell you, I did not. It didn't even register. You were quoting the episode. So there's my fandom fail for the day.
It is now in the rotation. Yes.
I use it every time I have to talk to students, I think, from now on. So, I don't know. We're kind of winding down time-wise. Is there anything else about this episode that we haven't talked about that you want to say?
I will talk about this with almost every episode of the show. One of the things that it does so well, and whenever I teach TV, I have to teach students how to watch TV, which involves getting them to learn how to look for A stories, B stories, potential C and D stories. And often those things are disparate, right? This A story is over here and the B story is over here. The episode concludes. You move on to the next episode. One of the things that Murder, She Wrote does well, which also is done well in Seinfeld, is the way that they take all of those different stories and find a way to mash them together in a really elegant way at the end of the episode. So every episode of Murder, She Wrote feels ultimately very satisfying, which I think is part of the queer appeal of the show, too. You know that all of this messiness is going to be wrapped up and put away. So it's a comforting show to watch in that way. Some people say, oh, you know, my comfort show is Game of Thrones. I don't understand that at all. But Murder, She Wrote, even though there's a murder in literally every episode, Murder, She Wrote is so comforting because, you know, no matter what, Jessica's going to go home and sit at that typewriter and somehow write a book at the end of the episode. And there's just something lovely about that.
Yeah. The murder will always be caught. I mean, that's the imperative of the cozy mystery that we talk about a lot on this podcast. And that's part of the satisfaction. Justice will always prevail. You can trust in that. There's always going to be, it's not a happy ending per se because someone is still dead, but it's a satisfying ending. And in this one, we get one of our coda scenes, which for season three, they kind of started doing away with, and now they're back again in season four, which makes me happy. So we get, after the big climax, when the murderer is outed and arrested, it's just Elmo's brother who killed him because he's an addict and he's running up the family fortune. Then we get like the final scene at the bus depot and Winnie saying goodbye to Winnie, and Winnie kisses Seth on the cheek and he's totally uncomfortable. And we get Seth and Jessica laughing when Seth says, oh, your in-laws, you know, they explain so much about you, Amos, like these crazy people. Like, of course, you're who you are. And the three of them are laughing. It's their friendly dynamic again. It's like back to the land of the familiar.
Great episode.
Also, William Wyndham looks really handsome in his fedora in this scene.
Gay.
So I guess that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette. I want to thank Taylor Cole Miller for joining me, and he'll be back next week. But for now, I'm Bridget Keys.
And I'm Taylor Miller.
And we'll catch you next time. The Cabot Cove Gazette's theme song is Reaching the Sky by Alexander Nakarada, used under Creative Commons license. You can find us on social media. We're Cabot Cove Gazette on Facebook and @Cove Gazette on Instagram and Twitter.